Hello and welcome to this one-off episode of the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Charlotte Henry, who is also a political journalist and the author of Not Buying It, The Facts Behind Fake News. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, Emma. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, I'm good. Sort of settling into summer a bit. So yeah, it's good.
Great. Yes, we finally got some sunshine.
We're recording this on a very nice day anyway. We'll see how long it lasts.
Yes, absolutely. The first obvious question is, why this book? Why now?
So it is an obvious question, but actually I think it's the right question, because I think I wanted to write this book because I was kind of, as you've known, because we've known each other a while, I've always been fascinated in this kind of intersection between politics, the media and tech. And obviously the subject of fake news covers all of those things very clearly. Now it is a prominent issue of our time. It's a key issue of our time that is having an effect here and now. And I think that is really, really important to... The nice thing about books, so you and I write columns and stuff and you turn those things around very quickly and it's kind of, yes, I'll write that, I'll file it in 2 hours and it's done. The nice thing, and also, spoiler alert, the torturous thing about writing a book is it takes quite a long time. And the nice thing is doing that actually gives you a chance to step back a bit. And I think that's what this subject required. And as I was writing it, more and more stuff was happening. Just as I was about to finish the manuscript, the Mueller report even was put out. It was kind of both exhilarating that the subject of the book was so live, which is the answer to your question, why now?
Yeah.
Because it is live now. And also kind of exhausting to try and keep up with the pace of what was going on.
Fair enough. And what do you want the book to ultimately achieve?
You mean apart from worldwide stardom and fame for me?
Well, of course. Yeah, I mean, that goes without saying.
I think what we need to do is start looking at this subject seriously. There have been some very good books on it previously. James Ball wrote a very good book on it. Matthew Dan Kona wrote a very good book on it. I actually have to confess, I haven't had a chance to read Evan Davis's one on it, but his also, I believe, is very good. So there was about 18 months ago, there's these three books on a similar subject that came out. And I was lucky that I had a little bit more time to step back and look at the subject as it evolved. So I hope that's what the book achieves, which is actually an ability to look at this issue in the round.
And it seems to me there are kind of two core strands in the book that are sometimes pulled together and sometimes, in my opinion, diverge, and you may differ from me on that. One of which is about political extremity and the other is fake news. And I'd be interested in unpacking fake news to be politically extreme, or for the political extremes to thrive, in your opinion?
I think it really helps them. I think we see regularly that it really helps them, for sure.
What do you mean? How do you mean by that?
So if you think of people like, let's go for the obvious extremist examples, the Trumps, the Farages, the whatever, you know, those kind of people. I do feel that they benefit from perhaps not directly fake news, although there are quite clearly instances of specific fake news that they benefit from. But I think they very much benefit from this post-truth environment. Some people have started to call it populism as well. But I think they absolutely benefit from this lack of trust in the, air quotes, the elite, the establishment, again in air quotes. And I think that all comes into the post-truth mindset. So I think that is where the extremists prosper.
I mean, I think I would agree with you that they absolutely benefit from the extreme responses to the lack of trust.
Right,
exactly. Is absolutely right. I'm just wondering if that lack of trust has to be because of a benign influence of fake news, or if those institutions in which we've lost trust have lost trust for a reason.
Oh, absolutely. And in the book, I lay out some of the very clear reasons why we might have lost trust in some of these institutions. So I think I mentioned we've lost trust in politics. A key part of that was the expenses scandal. It wasn't the only reason, but it did. The people lost trust in government a lot over the Iraq war. People lost trust in the media a lot over phone hacking. Now, it's very, very crude to say these are the only reasons why those things happen, but I think they're key tenets, you know.
I think those are definitely the moments, aren't they, that exactly. people would come to. My sort of wider question is, did those moments happen in isolation, or is there a wider malaise within these institutions that these moments may be exemplified, where people didn't see themselves being represented properly, didn't see their views being represented either in the media or in politics, and as such then could point to these pinnacles of awfulness the 1/9 of the iceberg, as it were.
So I suspect that is right, and I think people are probably a bit irritated with Westminster before MPs' expenses.
Yeah.
But then MPs' expenses confirmed all their worst fears about it.
Yeah, yeah.
People were irritated with the tabloid press, and then they found out about phone hacking. Mm-hmm. So I suspect there is some truth into what you're saying, but I think those specific incidents did move it on a gear and laid the foundation for a post-truth environment for believing fake news.
When you talk in the book about fake news, and I should say, I have read the book. It's really well written. It's very interesting. It's quite polemic. You're very welcome. It's quite polemical, and I'm not always sure I agree with the points that you're making, but I always enjoy the way you make them. So we should enjoy unpacking that.
I'll take that.
When you talk about fake news, you also mention propaganda. And do you see that is there a difference between propaganda and fake news?
Sometimes, but not always. I think there's a lot of propaganda.
What would you say is the difference?
Well, whether there's some truth, I think the level of truth involved. I think when you talk about propaganda in the kind of traditional advertising-y political spin, that kind of sense, I don't think a lot of that would be fairly categorised as fake news. And you'll notice at the start of the book, I'm quite specific when I talk about what fake news is. I think that's really important. And we can come on to discuss why that is in a bit. But because I'm very specific and say very clearly that fake news has to be something that people know is fake, or that, you know, they have, and that they intentionally share for political and or financial reasons. That's kind of the sort of one sentence where I think of fake news. I think there's obvious cases of propaganda where that does meet that qualification, and plenty of occasions where it's just a bit, you know, over the top advertising, propagandary, you know. So I think
I'm thinking of some of the stuff that you discuss later on in the book, like the use of statistics by politicians. I would probably class that more propaganda than fake news in under that definition that you just gave, but it's definitely part of the same family.
So you're right, it's definitely part of the same family. I think where it comes into fake news, so these are one of the examples I use is how Damien Hines and the Education Department got told off for some of the stats they use. And the point is they used them when they'd been told there was an issue. And yes, you're right, you could be generous and just say, oh, look, it's just politics, it's just spin. But I think in some uses where people distort statistics, there is something a little bit more sinister.
Yeah, I mean, I think all political parties are guilty of this.
Definitely.
Labour, for example, will take the most extreme definition of a cut to the NHS.
Sure.
So even if the NHS budget is going up year on year, it may well be the case that that's actually a real terms cut because you've got more people using it, the social care crisis. And then that's how all that will be presented as an overall cut. Yeah. The other obvious example from your world would be a bar chart.
I was thinking of the famous Lib Dem bar charts, which
indeed.
I'm not active in the party anymore, but I know exactly what you're talking about. We've all seen the famous Lib Dem bar chart.
That's not how accesses work.
It's not how it. That's at least one of the problems. Yeah. So yeah, no, look, that type of thing. I mean, you could put, you know, it's deliberate, it's knowing, it's looking to gain political advantage. Mm. I think it's pushing its luck a bit, but also I know what you mean if you kind of feel somewhat more generous and kind of put it into just the silly political propaganda. But I think the reason why I mention it in the book and talk about it in the book is because it's part of a wider post-truth thing where people just don't trust anything. So one politician says one statistic, one person says the other, and the general public go, bleh.
Yeah, absolutely, you know? Absolutely. And no, completely. And I think there is, you also talk in the book about that truthiness sense. So, well, that stat may not
isn't
be
isn't that a fantastic
actually true.
Word? I wish I'd come up with that. I loved it when I found it. I wish I'd come up with it, but... It's this idea that there's kind of, it sounds a bit true. There might be a little bit of truth to it, but it's not really. And it's, you know, in journalism, there's sometimes that old fashioned thing of too good to check.
I don't think
people do it now, but that used to be the, you know, bit of an old joke. It's such a good story. It's too good to try and stand it up. You just write it. So I think the kind of truthiness thing comes into that as well.
So I want to sort of just get your take on the news side before I go on to the other strand of the politics side. And I mean, you come up with some conclusions in the book. So what do you think ultimately the solutions to fake news are going to be?
So I'll be candid with you. The hardest section of the book to write was the solutions bit.
Yeah.
But as you might imagine,
It was. I mean, if we knew those, right?
Right, exactly. And look, it was really easy to identify loads of the problems. It was a bit harder to try and dig out where it came from, but it was really fascinating research. And I did some really interesting interviews with people. They were interesting. And so all that was fine. And then it came to this bit where I knew I had to try and offer something. Mm. And it was really hard. And one of the answers, which a lot of people have advocated and I really, really believe in, is media literacy. I'm sure you can remember this when you were going to university, and I remember it as well, that kind of sneering at media studies and those kind of things. And even, you know, further back, how people talk about, you know, trying to decipher the media. And we're just not very good at media literacy. We've never taken it seriously. We've never asked people to really understand where their news comes from. And I think we actually, as journalists, have to take a little bit of responsibility for that. We never really wanted to show our working. We've always been quite happy to say, you know, there's that joke, isn't there, on Twitter, journalese, where journalists talk to one another in a kind of language that no normal people could understand. And we sometimes write in that as well. You know, people should understand what a well-placed source means, a seed, you know, those kind of things. Explain, people should understand why people don't want to put their names to stuff. People should explain how actually there's quite a rigorous process to getting a story into print. You don't just sit down at a computer, hear a couple of bits of gossip and write it down. But people, consumers of media, don't understand that. And they, you know, and because there's been bad journalism, which I look at in the book, people have just distrusted all of it. And actually, it's important that people, because of that lack of trust, understand how the sausage factory a bit, understand how the journalism is made. Because I think
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I'm not sure it's the whole solution, but it's definitely a part of it.
It absolutely isn't the whole solution. The whole solution involves, you know, the politicians now taking advantage of fake news, going on a bit of a moral high ground and not. It involves the social media companies who propagate this stuff, taking some kind of action and balancing that with the importance of free speech online. It involves all those things, but the one thing we could all do for ourselves is improve our media literacy.
I think that's absolutely fair. So coming on to the sort of second strand of thought, which is I think where we may disagree a little more.
Ooh, fun.
You sort of talk about fake news as antithetical to the liberal centre. And the liberal centre, the rightness of the liberal centre is sort of implied in your book. It's, you know, that the rightness of that isn't questioned. But does the liberal centre not have its own biases and propaganda?
Oh, I mean, yeah, for sure. We all have our own biases and propaganda. My point is, I think that smaller liberalism, there's an inquisitiveness and I can't say truthiness now, but there's a kind of importance put on truth and investigation and kind of thought, that kind of thought process in traditional liberal philosophy and thinking. And for me, and of course, look, I'm coming from my own politics as well. And we can't, I can't pretend that it's not to that prism. That's why I wrote it as I did. And you're absolutely right to point that out. But I think that the point about liberal centrist politics, I feel, look, for years, we kind of know that was the perceived wisdom, wasn't it? The third way, although one could argue that lost a lot of its small L liberalism towards the end. But anyway, we had a kind of consensus. The Francis Fukuyama thing is the end of history, all of that. And in the last few years, that seems to have gone. We've got, I would argue, quite an extreme Tory party, quite an extreme Labour party, an extreme US president, a rampant Brexit party. All these kind of things within our politics are changing, in my point of view. And it absolutely correlates to this collapse in the of that liberal centrist politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think the collapse of the liberal centrist politics is probably unarguable. The question I have in my mind is, can you separate economic liberalism, to which I do not subscribe, from social liberalism, to which I do? Because in the book, they're largely either conflated or interchangeable at times. And I think that's probably the interesting question. So you and I would both oppose Donald Trump, but would have very different approaches to, say, a more socialist Democrat.
Yeah,
who would also oppose Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. That's completely fair. And of course you can, and plenty of people do. Plenty of people within both the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats here in the UK would perhaps be social liberals and less economic liberals. For me, small-L liberalism encompasses both. And I think that's important. I think part of that has been lost. That kind of, I think there's too often, it's too often taken for granted that people with social liberal values have also a centre-left approach to economics, if that makes sense. Whereas actually, I think, and look, we saw this personified, to my mind, in the coalition government, and you know, there's individuals as well you could call out. There is a strand of politics which I personally, you know, think is important, that combines the two.
Combines social liberalism and centre-right thinking.
Well, and liberal economics.
Yeah. I mean, I see, this is, I think the question, I suppose, for me is a matter of emphasis. In the book, you praise the coalition government for tax cuts and gay marriage, which, in, you're absolutely right, that for you is you know, classical liberal economics and social liberal politics. But for me, I think that a lot of what happened under the coalition years drove the extremism, and before the coalition years. So, you know, if we take 2008 and the crash as a baseline, and the failure of free markets to run the economy, to police themselves properly, which is,
at least the institutions involved in those markets,
yeah, which, if you know, how do you really separate the institutions from the things when they are what brought the thing down? So, and then the response to that was not Keynesian economics; it was more, much more, you know, austerity, which is the opposite of Keynesianism. So for me, that was an extremist response economically. I don't think of that as a centrist response.
But again, that's possibly more, that's more a personal politics perhaps coming
indeed
through. So I think, and that, you can't call it particularly extreme. For me, extremists are things like the collapse of the Venezuelan economy and, you know, that kind of thing. I would, you know, I would argue some of what Jeremy Corbyn.
I just feel like, sorry, I'm interrupting you, and I don't think I've made my point properly. I feel like it was extreme, but a slow extreme. So it was like the boiling a frog analogy, which is apparently not true, but it's such a wonder. It's got truthiness.
It's truthiness.
You know,
yeah,
the boiling a frog analogy, where you put a frog in a pan of boiling water,
is that
it'll
not
jump
true
straight out. Apparently not. Oh. If you put a pan in and heat it slowly, it will stay in there and boil to death. And I feel like that's what kind of happened. We ended up with the cuts being salami slices. And yeah, and people are now really suffering, and people on welfare, and particularly the poorest end of society, really don't feel that they got the economy back on track, if you see what I mean. So for me, that does feel extreme if you're in those circumstances.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
But I don't think it does. But I don't think, whatever you think of the politics of David Cameron, George Osborne and Nick Clegg, I don't think there is any useful criteria of the word extremist to which they fit.
So I'm not sure that that's true, because wasn't Thatcher be considered quite extreme, certainly in 1979 at the end of Buskerism?
I suppose, yes, maybe in that context. I mean, I don't know. I would say Thatcher is perhaps more hardline than the three gentlemen I've just named.
Maybe. I mean, I feel like it was a finishing of the project, the shrinking of the state. And where I come at that from is having worked in local government,
sure,
where cuts were sort of 30-40%. That's an enormous cut.
Yeah, look, it's significant. There's no denying that. But what I say, when I'm talking about extreme, like, you know, I mean, these are not particularly, they're not driven by an extremist ideology. Yes, they might want, they might want a state that is smaller than the state you would want. And that's fine. That's, you know, that, but that, you know, you having that conversation with George Osborne, I would say, is in the kind of spectrum of political norms. Whereas, dare I suggest, Jeremy Corbyn having, or John McDonnell having that conversation with, say, Boris Johnson, I would say that is more, actually, Boris Johnson is perhaps not a good example, or even a Nigel Farage, is you've absolutely moved the window, or you've absolutely shifted that political spectrum a long way away from that centre point.
I mean, I think it does depend where the centre is. I think we assume the centre is somewhere. I think everybody, not we, and not we, but we all assume the centre point is roughly where we are. I generally don't, but that's because I'm insecure. I generally assume everyone disagrees with me. But I think there is and I think this is where I'm trying to come to. It's not that I think David Cameron, George Osborne, Nick Clegg were in and of themselves extremists, but that they were more extreme than the midpoint centre they think they are.
Perhaps as individuals, I think collectively, through the kind of combination of what a coalition is required, and one could argue the state of the economy at that time and all those kind of things, I would say they as individuals are within a kind of fairly midpoint of politics, and I would say the government they led, you know, you're perfectly entitled to come at it, critique it from the left. That's, you know, that's a perfectly reasonable critique. And there are plenty of other people on the right who say it was far too soft. They should have cut more. They should have been tougher. They should have done X, Y, Z. And I think the fact that you can have that conversation, if nothing else, probably proves that fairly within a fairly midpoint of politics.
So I think the other question, I feel like we've gone back a few years.
You and I.
It does. Yeah, here we go. We're having a conversation we used to have 4 or 5 years ago. So taking it out of the coalition years, and I think this is something that is applicable to New Labour, for example, or Clintonism, third way politics in general. Is there a question of... I 100% agree with all the stuff that you say in the book about conspiracy theories. And I think conspiracy theories are really damaging and dangerous. But I do think sometimes there's a non-conspiratorial conspiracy of what gets ignored or what doesn't get valued. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, what I assume you're talking about is a thing like you'll say, you know, you might find... the kind of bias that we have within the media that, you know, a lot of it's based in London or Manchester.
Yeah.
And if the story isn't relevant to one of those big cities, it often gets overlooked. Whereas actually, for example, like a great example is how much we don't talk about the demise of Britain's coastal towns and seaside towns.
Yeah, a very good example. That's a very good example. And where the economy that works in big cities absolutely does not work in those towns.
So... yes, I don't. But I also agree with what I think you're saying is that there's not a malicious conspiracy not to talk about, say, those communities or that kind
of thing. So what I was thinking about when I was thinking about forming this question, I was thinking about Grenfell Tower. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely 100% do not believe that there was a conspiracy to kill the residents of Grenfell Tower.
No.
But there was a neglect... so there was almost a conspiracy of neglect. And that's what I'm... so what I'm guarding against is conspiratorial thinking on the one hand, but also not putting the pieces together on the other. And that's a really complicated place to be.
It's a really complicated place to be, but I think you're absolutely right to raise the issue. Grenfell Tower was kind of... I don't want to say playing out, but the repercussions were still ongoing as I was writing the book. So there is some reference to it, but I couldn't go into it with the depth that perhaps I actually think it probably deserves within this topic. But, you know, the example you're talking of, for example, people found pretty quickly after the horrendous fire, didn't they, a blog post from the Residents Association really complaining about, I think, the cladding am I remembering that right?
Yeah, the cladding and the fire safety measures were both brought up, yeah.
And
I'll tell you where you do amplify this very well in the book is around Hillsborough.
Yes.
And it's a very similar sort of thing. And I think driven by the same sense that we are the kind of communities that don't matter.
So, look, we have to be very, very careful when we discuss Hillsborough because obviously the police commander on the day is now back on trial.
Yeah.
He's facing a retrial. So I had to tread carefully in the book, as is right and proper, and we'll tread carefully in this conversation.
Indeed.
What is clear with that Sun headline, the Truth headline, was that because... what was clear from that headline is that the Sun, in its leadership at the time or whatever else, could believe that the Liverpool fans were at fault because you could say... look what they've done before. And it was really difficult chapter to write because, you know, I started writing about the Heysel disaster that had happened before, which the Liverpool fans do accept culpability for. And people were arrested and imprisoned. And that's a really uncomfortable thing to deal with because what we know now from the Hillsborough inquiry is that it wasn't the fans on that day. But we also know because of stuff that had happened in the past, it was easy to believe it might have been.
Mm-mm. Yeah. And I think coming back at it from the other direction, what seems to have been the case, and again, you know, treading carefully around what's currently in court, but we're talking about in court, you know, 30, 40 years later, that the sense from that community that when it was them at fault, there were arrests, justice was seen to be served. When it wasn't them at fault and it was seen to be the fault of the state, the media, the government, there wasn't a sense that justice was ever served. And that imbalance can lead to a sense of conspiratorial thinking that isn't 100% wrong, but isn't 100% right. And that, I think, was a really interesting grain within the book.
It comes back to that idea of truthiness also, doesn't it? That something doesn't have to be, look, it doesn't have to be a the Pope endorses Donald Trump style fake news for it to be really for the conspiracy to grow, for that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so what's next for you? What's coming up?
A nap, I think. I mean, it was a pretty shattering experience writing that book, and I enjoyed doing it. But yeah, it definitely takes a lot out of you. But obviously, love talking about it. Want to go and I want to keep looking at this issue because I think we're living in an age now where this combination of tech and media and politics, that kind of midpoint in the Venn diagram where they all come together, is becoming more and more important. And as a journalist and a commentator, I love looking into that. I love talking to clever people about it and hearing what they have to say and how they're trying to fix these problems. And so that's kind of where I'm really enjoying focusing my journalism at the moment.
Great. And if people want to find you on social media, what have you? I mean, presumably, even though we all know it's inherent problems now, you are still on social media.
I'm still there, still getting all the abuse and the seeing all the nonsense. No, it's at Charlotte Henry on Twitter and Charlotte Henry on Facebook as well. And my website is charlotteahenry.com.
Brilliant.
The book's over on Amazon. Of course.
Excellent. Of course. And once again, the book is called Not Buying It, The Facts Behind Fake News. And congratulations. It's a cracking read. I mean, I read it in two sessions. So,
I'm really flattered. I have to tell you, it's a really horrifying process to speak to someone who has read your book. Like, it's a bit like asking someone to judge your child. And how beautiful, you know what I mean? Is my baby really beautiful? Like,
what I can absolutely say is, while I, you know, as we've enjoyed going through today, I've questioned some of the concepts in it. I enjoyed the fact that I was reading it and thinking as I went along.
Oh, good.
Which is always a good recommendation. And never, ever only read things you agree with.
Well, exactly. And I kind of... I hate to put it in this way, but I kind of was a bit fed up of reading stuff that was kind of very clearly centre left or very clearly centre right. And I wanted to put something that was the kind of politics we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, that combination of social and liberal and economic liberalism, I don't see gets much sway. Now, I'm sure we could do a whole nother podcast on why that might be, but I kind of wanted to put a little bit back as to, you know, for that kind of politics. And I thought the fake news issues really were related to it, and the more I was writing, the more I could see the issues related to the kind of politics we're seeing at the moment and the rise of fake news.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. It's been really, really interesting talking to you. Good luck with the book and the inevitable international book tour and everything that comes next. and yeah, as I say, the book is available on Amazon and probably all good bookshops. Not Buying It by Charlotte Henry.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, Charlotte. Great. So, just to say that this has, thank you to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.